Deutsche Welle, Africa Link.
And on this edition of Africa Link with me, Crispin Mwakideu, hundreds of Burundians are fleeing violence to Tanzania, creating a huge challenge to the UN Agency for Refugees.
There is overcrowding, and our problem has been that had the numbers stopped from coming in from Burundi, we would then have been able to decongest more measurably.
And a South African documentary on Marikana killings scoops an Emmy Award in New York, but back home, broadcasters refuse to air it.
The whole idea was to cover the truth from the people so that they won't know what transpired. But of course, the people know that the state agencies like the police were on the wrong side.
Plus, what does garbage and honey have in common? Money. Stay tuned to find out how two men from two separate countries are earning cash from West and bees.
Top story.
Let's begin with the crisis in Burundi. The US on Monday imposed sanctions on four top officials, including the country's public security minister, Alain Guillaume Bunyoni. Washington accuses the four Burundians of playing a role in the country's unrest. Meanwhile, Burundi suspended 10 NGOs over allegations of anti-government activities. Tens of thousands of Burundians have fled to neighbouring Tanzania. Joyce Menskoll, the Tanzanian representative of the UN Refugee Agency, UNHCR, has been telling my colleague Mark Caldwell how they have been coping with the numbers.
Let me say that the very difficult situation in Burundi, of course, has contributed to this outflow since, if I can say, the first week of May. And it has spiked at certain times where we've had, you know, mass inflow. At one point, I think it was just before the parliamentary elections, we had 6,000 over sort of a three-day period. However, right now we are getting about 176 on a daily basis. So there is overcrowding, and our problem has been that had the numbers stopped from coming in from Burundi, we would then have been able to decongest more measurably and significantly Nyarugusu camp.
Will these camps be big enough?
It very much depends on water. If we are, at the moment, we have water in Induta, and the government has agreed to an expansion of Induta, the area of Induta. They have also now exceptionally looked at Mutendeli, and also agreed to expand the area. But the problem is the search for water, because obviously we cannot put people into a camp unless there is water.
You said that water is a problem, so presumably disease is also a problem as well.
As you may remember, when we had the first influx, the mass influx, they came into a very small peninsula area. And because of the congestion there, there was an outbreak of cholera, but we and our partners worked very assiduously to, and we lost only, when I say only, it's terrible that we lost 29 people, but we could have lost 1,000, you know, given the particular circumstances of Kagunga.
Does the UNHCR have the resources it needs to cope with this crisis?
If there was a mass influx today, we are not ready. And that is, of course, in part because, as I told you, we have not been able to prepare all the camps, right, because of, in some measure, a lack of resources, but equally importantly, to find water. With climate change and degradation of land, I believe it has had an impact, you know, on those sites, in particular Karago. And that's why we're trying to find a drill that can go even that, you know, deeper than previous boreholes. You know, we'd have to dig very deep, and that's what we're now trying to do.
Joyce Menskoll, UNHCR representative in Tanzania. The UN says more than 240 people have been killed in Burundi since April, but observers say the number could be higher. Reports of heavy gunfire and grenade explosions have become more frequent in the capital, Bujumbura. Yolande Buka, an analyst with the Institute for Security Studies in Nairobi, has just returned from Burundi, and Mark Caldwell asked her about her impression of the country.
What's most concerning is the bodies that are found continuously through the streets of Bujumbura, particularly in some of the neighborhoods that were the heart of the protest a few months ago. And the fact that it's ongoing despite international pressures and international involvement in trying to resume negotiations between the opposition and the ruling party is quite worrying.
Who do you think was behind the violence at the weekend?
You know, there's been quite a bit of speculation with regards to an armed opposition, but this armed opposition is not necessarily acting as a single unit. So identifying which faction of the armed opposition is engaged in such violence is difficult to determine. Moreover, there is continued violence at the hand of security forces, which is also important to note at the present time.
So is there any chance of dialogue between the opposing factions?
The most important thing to determine with regards to this dialogue is first, where is it going to take place? When is it going to take place, and identifying who are the actors that are going to be involved in the mediation. At the moment, the government is very much focused on the inter-Burundian dialogue that is taking place, but the international community is calling for a genuine and inclusive dialogue, which would evidently include some members of the opposition who currently live in exile. Until we've determined who are going to be the actors around the negotiation table, it's very difficult to talk about then what will be on the agenda for the negotiations.
The International Conference on the Great Lakes Region, the 12-nation regional bloc, is pulling its headquarters out of Burundi. How do you assess the significance of this?
The relocation is temporary. The letter that was sent to the Minister of External Relations obviously explained that the move was temporary. However, the fact that ICGLR determined that the security situation in Bujumbura was not good enough to maintain operations goes in line with other organizations such as the European Union, which has pulled out their non-essential personnel. So obviously ICGLR is not acting in a vacuum. It's also acting in line with other organizations and governments who have removed their people from there.
Last week, the UN Security Council asked Secretary General Ban Ki-moon to report within 15 days on options for boosting the UN presence in Burundi. What role could the UN play in this crisis?
You know, when we look at what the UN could do, there's been talk about pulling some of the troops in or peacekeeping troops in Eastern DRC and transferring them into Burundi. There's been also discussions about the East African Standby Force and potentially deploying them into Burundi. I'm not quite sure to what extent this is actionable in the immediate. Most of these provisions have been discussed as contingency plans. Should mediations fail, should the situation on the ground significantly worsen, at the moment, most of the actors regionally and internationally are much more favorable towards mediation than military intervention.
Yolande Buka from the Institute for Security Studies in Nairobi.
News, analysis, and feature reports. All that here on Africa Link.
Honored away, but shunned at home. The South African documentary titled Miners Shot Down has won top honors at the International Emmy Awards. The documentary, which tells the story of the 2012 Marikana killings through the eyes of the miners, was awarded Best Documentary at a ceremony held in New York last night. Despite such international acclaim, two major South African broadcasters refused to air the documentary directed by Rehab Desai. As Tuzo Komalo reports from Johannesburg, South African television viewers are disappointed and are now blaming the government.
The 16th of August 2012 is a day many South Africans will never forget. On this day, police sprayed a hail of bullets on striking miners who were demanding better salaries, leaving 34 of them dead and scores injured. Filmmaker Rehad Desai captured most of it on camera and approached television stations for extra footage to produce a moving documentary that has attracted international attention. Some international broadcasters have aired it too. However, Desai says South Africa's two popular broadcasters, the South African Broadcasting Corporation, SABC, and ETV, have refused to air this documentary. This has angered a lot of South Africans. Many are accusing the government of ordering the police to shoot the miners, and Zugiswa Mehlomakulu from Eastern Cape says he thinks this is the main reason why the South African Broadcasting Corporation, or SABC, the country's public broadcaster, has refused to air the documentary.
I always blame the government. They have the connection to this type of stuff, you know, and they control what needs to be exposed and what is not needs to be exposed, you know.
Others think the actions of these stations are meant to protect Deputy President Cyril Ramaphosa, who many allege gave the orders that led to the shooting. This is despite the fact that Ramaphosa was cleared of any wrongdoing by the Commission of Inquiry, which investigated the killings. 32-year-old Sandile Nkosi says that by refusing to air the documentary, the local stations have deprived South Africans of their right to know, and they should be dragged to the ombudsman to explain their actions.
People should have a voice anywhere they are and have access to information that is vital for their self-worth and self-determination, you know?
And media commentator and freelance writer Ndumiso Mlilo describes the action of the two broadcasters as unfortunate.
The whole idea was to cover the truth from the people so that they won't know what transpired. But of course, the people know that the state agencies like the police were on the wrong side. Any attempt to muzzle such kind of documentaries usually have got a way of coming up and the people get to know the truth.
3 years down the line after this tragedy, the surviving miners and families of those who were killed are yet to receive the amount of salaries they fought for or compensation for the deaths. Like many other South Africans, they say whether the documentaries aired locally or not, the fight for better wages is a battle they will fight until they win.
And that report was compiled by Tuzo Kumalo in Johannesburg.
Africa on the Move.
This week's Africa on the Move story leads us to the tiny Central African nation of Gabon. And here we meet one local businessman in the town of Lambarene. This entrepreneur felt so frustrated by the inability of the local authority to collect garbage that he decided to do it himself. This report by Jan Philip Scholz is now read by Privilege Moshaniri.
Men dressed in bright and reflective orange overalls are busy at work in one of the garbage dumps in Lambarene. They are the staff of Global Services, a company founded and managed by businessman Fairman Makaya. Several times a week, they visit Lambarene market and sort out the enormous waste. Organic waste goes into the pink bags and plastic in the blue. As the men work around the heaps of garbage, CEO Fairman Makaya tells DW that waste separation is something foreign to the locals.
Unfortunately, here the people are used to just throwing their garbage on the street. Many simply do not understand why they should think about waste separation and recycling. That is why we have to explain to them the importance of this over and over again, not only the residents, but also the city administration.
For years, the small town of Lambarene has had a problem with waste management. The city's waste management exists only on paper. This inefficiency by authorities is what motivated Makaya to create a garbage collection company. The 37-year-old rented a small office and established a team of 8 strongmen. Residents of Lambarene now hold the garbage collectors in high esteem.
It is very nice to see what they are doing here, because a clean environment helps everybody who works here.
We used to have really too much garbage here, but since the people of Global Services started their operations, you can see a difference.
The company has two tricycles which transport the garbage daily to the depository on the outskirts of Lamrin, where the waste is burnt in open air. For Makaya, this is the most unpleasant part of the work.
This, of course, is not good, not only for the health of the people who work here, but also for the environment that we actually want to protect.
As part of the solution, Makaya and his team are now working on the next step of his garbage project.
Of course, it's a difficult and lengthy process. To be honest, I have sometimes thought of giving up. But today, I am more than convinced that we will succeed.
They want to construct a recycling plant in the jungle of Lamrin. The plastic waste will be mixed with sand to create a cement-like brick. The bricks could then be used for road construction. The land has already been purchased and cleared. What is missing is the money. Makaya has already found a producer whom he could convince about his recycling idea. He wants to give him the sand at a special price. Until then, a lot of plastic will be collected. And there is a lot everywhere in the streets of Lamrin.
And that report was written by Jan Philip Scholz. As we leave the men collecting plastics in Lamrin, let's cross into northeastern Ethiopia. In this region, female genital mutilation, or FGM, is still being practiced. The cut, as it is also known, causes severe pain and more often leads to health complications. According to the World Health Organization, every year, an estimated 3 million girls in Africa are at risk of being subjected to FGM. Koleta Wanjohi reports.
In the northeastern part of Ethiopia is the Afar region. The Afar region is more than 580 kilometers from the capital city, Addis Ababa. And here in Afar, the rate of female genital mutilation or cutting is alarming. 60% of girls under the age of 14 years are subjected to female genital mutilation, placing the region second after Somalia. Aisha is a 17-year-old girl at the Semera boarding school. Aisha says that she doesn't remember her own experience of being cut because she was young, but she witnessed that of her 7-year-old sister. She says the pain and torture she saw the baby going through still haunts her until now. If I had the capacity to stop them, I would have stopped it. Now my feeling is if I had a child who was a girl, I would not circumcise her. My wish is for all the Afar people to stop female genital mutilation. I was really worried when I saw my sister being circumcised, and I wish I could have stopped it, but I couldn't. Boarding schools in Semera, the capital of the Afar region, like the one which Aisha goes to, are becoming a safe haven for those girls who haven't been genitally mutilated and want to escape it, and also a healing place for those who have undergone it like Aisha and want another life. The Chief Child Protection Officer at United Nations Children Education Fund, UNICEF, Ethiopia, Janabu Mahonde, explains that female genital mutilation totally violates the rights of a child and has dire implications not only to the girls but also the national health system.
A girl who has been cut sometimes, particularly with the worst form of the cutting, which is looking at removing completely the genitalia and then with the stitching. In a later stage, it's very difficult for girls to even urinate.
70 kilometers from Semera boarding school where Aisha is Barbara May Maternity Hospital that was opened up by an Australian woman who got married to a man from this Afar region and was devastated by the complications of the female genital mutilation. As Ato Johannes, the gynecologist at this hospital, explains, all the patients they receive have undergone female genital mutilation, and it is mainly during delivery that complications occur.
There are acute complications. That means complications that are happening right away during their childhood. What I am seeing here is the later complications, like they will come with cysts. They will form a cyst around their perineum.
In the hospital ward is a 7-year-old girl lying on a bed, quietly watching with sad eyes. Her mother sits next to her, looking very distant. The doctor explains that the 7-year-old girl has also undergone the brutal female genital mutilation. However, her complications are related to the fact that a 17-year-old man raped her. The doctor says that they have performed surgery and nothing more can be done. But reality is, she will have a difficult sexual life.
Coleta Wanjohi reporting from Ethiopia.
Making a difference.
Making money out of honey. That's how a former Cameroonian graduate is making a difference this week. Based on the outskirts of Cameroon's capital, Yaoundé, Timothy Awanga started beekeeping after failing to find a job. And now he's mastered the art of beekeeping and is even mentoring hundreds of others. Moki Kinzeka narrates his story.
Timothy Awanga, popularly known in Matom as Papa Miel or Papa Honey, moves colonies of honey bees from one of his 30 bee hives to another with his bare hands. He says he owns about 500,000 bees and believes each of them know him.
I make it a habit to visit my bees regularly so they will be able to know me and communicate with me without stinging me. For new beekeepers, they should visit their bees, stand a few meters from their hive, and repeat the exercise for several days. After that, they can go closer to the hive and open it, and the bees will know that you are visiting them.
Awanga Timothée left the University of Yaoundé 20 years ago after obtaining a bachelor's degree in geography. He spent 2 years in Cameroon's capital looking for a job in vain before deciding to return to his native village Matom, 70 kilometers to the south of Yaoundé, where he decided to make a living with bees.
The first bee charm is beeswax. Keep it somewhere in the forest and the bees will be attracted. The second thing to do is to collect a few bees that wander about in nature and keep them in a hive. They will attract other bees.
Thanks to bee farming, the Awanga now takes care of his wife and 4 children. He has also trained several hundred Cameroonians, including 30-year-old Jedone Zanga, whose first day in Timothy's bee farms was the day I was visiting.
Recently, I watched TV reports in which bees were being reared in Cameroon to facilitate access to honey. We were made to understand that honey has a promising future because of its therapeutic nature. It can treat wounds, it is used by diabetic patients, etc., etc. I decided to be trained to produce honey because we do not have it in sufficient quantities.
The government of Cameroon has been using Awanga's bee farms as pilot centers for bee farming. Through his success story, Cameroon now considers honey as one of the non-timber forest products in poverty reduction and biodiversity conservation. The country's livestock minister, Dr. Tiger, says bee farming is being encouraged in all agriculture training centers in the country, not only for job creation and revenue generation, but also for conserving the environment.
The centers train young people not only to become bee farming professionals, but to be able to create jobs and eventually become big entrepreneurs who can train other jobless young Cameroonians to economically empower themselves.
And that report was compiled by Moki Kinzeka in Yaoundé. You can join Africa Link next week on Tuesday for another Making a Difference story. Time now to brief you on our main stories. The UNHCR in Tanzania has said it is struggling to cope with high numbers of Burundian refugees. A South African documentary on the Marikana killings has won an Emmy Award, but 2 major South African broadcasters refuse to air it. We welcome your thoughts and opinions on the program. Simply send an SMS to country code 49160957 59510, an email to feedback.africa@dw.com, or a letter to Africa Link, DW 53110 Bonn, Germany. And you can also find more news on Africa by visiting dw.com/Africa. Thank you for listening. From me, Crispin Mwakideu. Stay safe.